DJ Mon Franco is here with me in the tent. We're broadcasting live from the 3CR Victoria Pride Street Party. I'm James from In Your Face. And yeah, that was Alison Moyet with her classic situation. Mon Franco, welcome.
Hello. Oh, wow. Thank you for having me. Thank you, James.
It's so exciting to have you on board. Now, you've got a hugely busy day. You're DJing three times. I can't believe it.
Yeah, so I'm DJing for Ciala at 2 p.m. at the Gertie stage, and then for Open Scene on Smith stage with Robert Baxter in July, and then 5:30 again with Ciala. Yeah.
Fantastic. Yeah. Now, Midsummer said that you were doing amazing things. It's just incredible. How excited and pumped are you to be doing all of it today?
Yeah, it like walking through this like the road, the streets. I was feeling emotional just like seeing all the stalls and the performances. I saw Rhymes before, and I was like, I'm just really happy to be here. Yeah.
And Casey Donovan is broadcasting real soon from the stage, playing from the stage. And as I was walking here, I was a bit emotional too, because there was a band that was just coming on, and I remember them on the stage at the very first Pride March in like 1996. And like, you know, 26 years later, they are back here in Smith Street. It's just incredible. But it's really, really important, isn't it, for FaceTime with people as well, catching up with people. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, especially after lockdown, sorry to mention. I remember like the first queer scene that I went to was with Minus 18. And that being face-to-face just like helped me break out of my shell. And like being here again, like at Pride last year I was here. It's always so heartwarming to just like meet people in person and be with friends and family and allies. Like, it's unreal.
And also just the political statements, I think, you know, of having a festival like this. Of course, it was established to celebrate 40 plus years of the decriminalisation of homosexuality in Victoria. And there's still so much activism that needs to be done. What words and emotions come up for you when you think of Pride?
Pride? Proud. Celebration, but also Midsummer, I think a lot about how well they do accessibility and diversity and how much like the music scene here in NAM has changed and developed. So when I think of Pride, I definitely think of the local scene and just being yourself and being authentic.
Because that's something you're really committed to, you know, queer people of colour in the music industry. Tell us about that. Tell us your backstory.
Yeah, definitely. Should I talk about Open Scene?
Yeah, because you're from Open Scene. Yeah. First of all, what is it?
Open Scene means opening safer spaces for queer people of colour, for DJs, performers, and giving them that platform and allowing them to be seen in an authentic way. I feel like I've said authentic so many times, but that's like, very accurate, I would say. And it's also a representation of myself as a queer Filipino DJ and artist. And also Mirza, who helped, you know, launch Open Scene in 2021, also with the support of Yaya Youth Services, so shout out to them. And since then, we've had 7 events so far, just booking DJs, queer POC DJs and artists and performers. And just like making that as accessible as we can, and giving our friends that space and family as well.
So what's it like for people to have that platform? What kind of, you know, growth and emergence have you seen in people who have been able to be involved with Open Scene and have that springboard in the music industry?
Well, I would say it's a special experience, especially for queer people of colour. When we launched Open Scene, you know, it was because Mirza and I like didn't feel as welcomed in the scene. And you know, you'd think that you'd feel welcomed and represented in the queer scene like as a young person, but then, you know, once you're in it, you know, sometimes it's not as, you know, it's not as safe as you would want it to be. So I think giving people that platform is better than doing nothing, if that makes sense.
It does. There has been a real visibility though in the last couple of years. It's been quite extraordinary. That must make people feel a lot more confident.
Well, I'd hope so. Yeah, definitely.
So tell us about safety.
Safety? Well, I think if the event or party or anything really is run by, you know, your community, then that's going to ensure safety. And that comes with representation as well and having those people in leadership.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I think leadership's really important because, you know, without leadership, you're not empowered.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, you had an exhibition in December called Continuum.
Yeah.
I love the images from it. Tell us all about it.
Oh, thank you. So Continuum was a collaborative event with Platform Exhibitions. We had it in December, and it was an art exhibition, an all queer and gender diverse lineup. I worked on the music side of that, so booking the DJs and performers. And Jess, the curator of Platform Exhibitions, did all the art stuff. So yeah, it was an honor to be a part of that, and it was at Meat Market Stables. It was an emotional experience as well. It was very overwhelming, and there were like families there, and it's something that I would have never imagined, like being a young queer person in the closet, quotation marks. But yeah, it was a really, unreal. Like, I still can't really fathom the experience. I think that was one of the best events that we've had so far. And we also released our zine, which highlights queer collectives as well in NAM. And in the zine, it has, Susie, my partner, wrote queer history, and we've also provided resources for young people in that zine. So yeah, just like putting that out there.
Fantastic. So zines have really made a comeback the last few years as well.
Yeah.
Fantastic. So tell us about some of the resources that you highlight.
Well, most of them are resources that we've been involved with, and that resources that have helped us. So I would say Invisible, a space for queer trans people of colour. A lot of my friends and I have been involved in that. Also Artkind, I'm trying to think off the top of my head. Headspace, Switchboard, definitely. And like youth services, you know, Yarra Youth Services. I predominantly like always hung out in the Yarra, like city of Yarra. And Freezer as well, which is a youth committee, and like a bunch.
That's great.
Top of my head.
That's
sorry.
So many connections. Yeah. Well, you must feel like you're having a party in your backyard today.
Oh yeah, definitely. I'm very excited for today. I'm very happy to be here.
So three events. Give us a plug for them that you're doing today here at the Victoria Street Party for Pride.
Yeah, three. What did you say? Sorry.
You're doing three, aren't you? Three, like you're DJing three times.
Oh yeah, yeah. I'm excited.
So overwhelming.
It's less stressful for me because I'm just literally pressing play and supporting the artists, and making sure they're okay as well, and feeling good. I'm very excited to do the Open Scene stage because July and Robert Baxter have been playing for Open Scene for like since the beginning. So it's very. It's an honour to have them play with us again.
Fantastic. Yeah. Well, yeah. DJ Mon Franco, it's been an absolute pleasure to chat with you from the 3CR special broadcast outside the station in our glorious marquee. Have fun today.
Thank you, I will.
You are in your face on 3CR. Up real soon, Alison Thorne. But in the meantime, we're going to hear a classic from Donna Giles. wonderful Donna Giles there. We are live here at 3CR from the street party, the Pride street party here in Smith Street. I am honoured to have legendary activist Alison Thorne with me here in the tent. Welcome.
Thank you, James. And isn't it fabulous being out on the street? It's quite something different.
It certainly is. I mean, you were an activist in 1979 fighting for the decriminalisation of homosexuality. Did you ever think that a day like this would happen?
Well, I mean, it is hard to think about it. It was 1979 when I came out and jumped headfirst into what was then gay liberation. Got involved in a whole host of things, but that included the Homosexual Law Reform Coalition, which then became the Gay Legal Rights Coalition. And it was really the tail end of many years of fighting when I got involved. And I was often asked, why as a woman this issue, you know, like, was an important issue. And really, the decriminalisation of gay male sexuality was really important for battling homophobia, because like, as long as gay male sex was actually in the criminal code, it was something that fueled homophobia. So it's great to be here today.
And of course, you know, police harassment and social discrimination, you know, people could lose their jobs if they were outed, people could be arrested. It must have been a very, very heady time, but also a frightening time to be gay or lesbian.
It was indeed a heady time. And one of the events that I got involved in that really inspired me and was a very important thing in my life was the 5th National Homosexual Conference. And many amazing things came out of that. But one of them was a decision to actually hold in the early part of 1980 a national summer offensive. And that summer offensive had a whole host of demands. It was taking up those issues of discrimination at work, police harassment, lesbian child custody rights, other issues which were equally important with decriminalisation. And while many people did an awful lot of lobbying in the lead up to homosexual law reform, the street actions that myself and others were involved in organising, like the National Summer Offensive, were enormously important.
Tell us about some of those street protests.
Well, I think it's really interesting when we think of something today like this street party. There will be a whole mix of people. There's a diversity of queers, but also a diversity of residents of Fitzroy and Collingwood mixing and mingling. But really, we stood out back in the late 70s and early 80s, you know, like, we were really an unusual sight to see, being out, proud, queer, and fighting for our liberation.
Now, you would have remembered the picnic day that was kind of like, you know, what turned into years later after decriminalisation was the carnival. But of course, what really set Midsummer going in those early years before it was even called Midsummer was a big picnic. Do you remember that?
Many of my friends were involved in those early gay liberation picnics, but that was before I actually came out. But I do certainly remember events like Gay Day, which was a very early celebration of winning law reform, but it was inside a stadium down in South Melbourne and behind closed doors. And what's so important is people coming out and being visible and proud.
What a change from today, you know, having to be behind closed doors back in 1979, and now in 2023, you know, it's so vibrant and out, and governments and corporations are clamouring to show that they've got the rainbow tick, effectively.
Well, you know, that's not something that actually impresses me. And we do look at things like Pride March, and we see marching, you know, like the police and the big corporations wanting to get on the bandwagon, but still for working class queers, for queers of colour, for those who are poor and homeless, that like the struggle is continuing. I mean, it's marvellous that we have Midsummer and that we have a street party, but we're still far from liberated. And the things that we have won are only as good for as long as we can hang on to them.
Absolutely. In the current climate with the far right, you know, hanging on to those things are something that we cannot take for granted. And we're seeing that in jurisdictions around the world, in Hungary, in Florida, all around the US with their oppressive anti-trans laws.
Oh, look, I mean, we are indeed seeing that. The highly conservative US Supreme Court, the rollback of Roe versus Wade, that just shows, you know, like really what's possible, that for decades pregnant people in the US thought that they would be able to get access to terminate a pregnancy if they needed that, but that's something that like that is now under threat for pregnant people in so many US states. And the Supreme Court is going after Native Americans. It's going after the queer community. And I think looking to that example of what's actually happening in the US is a timely reminder that any reforms that we win, we cannot take for granted, and we have to be ready to hang on to them. And we still have right here in Australia the Religious Freedoms Bill lurking in the background. And while what may be served up may be a little more benign than what the coalition was discussing, the Religious Freedoms Bill is still something that is potentially very problematic for our community, especially when we've got a government that is always looking to compromise.
Of course, in the early 1980s, you were very active in the beginning of the community's response to HIV/AIDS. You were at those first meetings that led to the establishment of the Victorian AIDS Council Gay Men's Health Centre, which is now Thorn Harbour. Of course, they named Thorn Harbour after you and the activist, the legendary activist Keith Harbour. Tell us about those days.
Well, I mean, it's really interesting to reflect on that in the context of what we're actually celebrating today, in the context of decriminalisation. And decriminalisation is something that was important, but it was really only one part of what was happening. There was a lot happening at that time. Queer caucuses were starting to form in trade unions. Every year there was the annual National Homosexual Conference, really important institutions, and the queer media was really kicking off. I was part of the collective that published Gay Community News a number of years, and thinking back to 3CR's own history, 3CR had its own Gay Liberation radio program. And I think that all of these things were critically important when HIV hit our community. It meant that many more people had come out, that we did have a community that you could point to that had a whole host of institutions, and that community was ready to be a voice to government, to speak out loud and proud, and to say, consult with us, listen to us, we are the experts when it comes to how we actually deal with this pandemic, because what we were dealing with was not only a health crisis, but also a potential political crisis.
Absolutely. And I mean, you know, having decriminalisation, the activism that created that springboard for the community to respond and pressure government to provide the infrastructure to respond to HIV/AIDS. And I imagine that would have been much easier with homosexuality decriminalised, with it no longer being a criminal offence, and easier for politicians, if you like, to respond to something that was more legitimate, even though it was still an incredibly stigmatised community and we saw, you know, the hysteria. But I imagine, you know, decriminalisation made it easier to respond to HIV/AIDS.
I think it did, but it wasn't just decriminalisation. It's what decriminalisation led to. The fact that more people could be open, could be visible, could be out and proud, that was just as important as decriminalisation itself. And it laid the foundation for a community, when faced with HIV/AIDS, was really ready to get organised.
Now, of course, you are from Radical Women Melbourne, you are from the Freedom Socialist Party, and you've got new digs in Reservoir. Tell us all about that.
Oh, we have indeed. After more than 20 years of Solidarity Salon being located in Brunswick, our building was sadly sold last year. And when faced with that, we began looking around and trying to figure where we would like to relocate to. And we have fantastic new premises in Reservoir at 113 Spring Street, right near the Regent Railway Station. And at the moment, members and supporters of both Radical Women and Freedom Socialist Party have been very busy refitting the place. We've just signed off on some fabulous signage that we have got going up very shortly. And everyone listening to 3CR should watch out for our opening celebration. It's going to be on the Sunday, the 26th of March, in the afternoon, and we really want everyone to drop down and celebrate with us as we begin a new era of Solidarity Salon in Reservoir.
Well, Alison Thorne, it's been an absolute delight to share this space with you under the tent, in the tent, here at the Victoria Pride Street Party and the 3CR special broadcast. Thank you so much for chatting with me.
Thank you, James.
You are an In Your Face on 3CR. We're going to hear some more music now, and this is Just Shy and Boyd Kelly with their track Mirrorball.
Champagne, no flowers, all flowers. I'll take your hand and then spin you out. eyes, the heat comes to your cheeks and they're redden. You're staring at my shirt, you don't know how to flirt. It's like an angel fallen from heaven. Boy, you could almost be my lover, but you gotta get off the wall. You know you're better than my exes, but I deserve a longer wall.
Show me the moon.
You will find me waiting for you underneath the river of gold.
I'll be saving you.
I'll see you later with your friends all collected in a bunker store.
This is 3CR Victoria's Pride Street Party Broadcast with In Your Face, live from Smith Street until 4pm. Listen now via 855am, 3CR Digital and 3cr.org.au/streaming. PJ Harvey there with her classic, This Is Love. We are broadcasting live from the Victoria Pride Street Party here in Smith Street. You are in your face on 3CR with James, joined by Paul Kidd, long-time HIV activist, LGBTIQ activist, and criminal defence lawyer. Welcome to 3CR.
Hey, thank you, James. It's fantastic to be here. Happy Pride.
Yeah, happy Pride to you. So what kind of feelings come up for you being here at this broadcast and this street party?
This is such a great event. It is fantastic to see so many people out on the street just, you know, celebrating the Pride. And, you know, this event was originally set up as a one-off by the Victorian government to mark the 40th anniversary of the decriminalisation of gay sex in Victoria, but it's really amazing that it's continuing on, and I hope it becomes a fixture in our calendar on the long term.
Absolutely. I mean, you've been fighting for decriminalisation in all kinds of areas. Of course, you're very active in the HIV Legal Working Group. In terms of decriminalisation, what work still needs to be done in Victoria?
Yeah, look, there's always more to be done. I think as I said, this event was introduced to mark a 40th anniversary of decriminalisation of gay sex. But queer people and trans people and people of colour and all the people in our community are groups of people that have traditionally been treated with suspicion and surveillance by governments and police. That stuff hasn't completely gone away, and we have to continue to remain vigilant about the way in which the criminal law affects our lives.
So what has the HIV Legal Working Group done in the space of ensuring the adoption of affirmative consent laws don't unintentionally criminalise people living with HIV and also trans and gender diverse people?
Yeah, this isn't something that people would probably be much aware of, because it's a good example of the kind of background, you know, backroom advocacy that is being done all the time in Victoria. The Legal Working Group's existed for about a decade now. It's just a small group that is co-auspiced by Thorn Harbour Health and Living Positive Victoria. We've worked on a whole range of things over the years. Probably the most significant of those was the campaign in 2014-2015 for the repeal of Section 19A, which was Australia's only serious criminal law that was targeting people with HIV, and we were successful in getting that criminal law repealed in 2015. More recently, I think a lot of people would be aware of the adoption of affirmative consent laws in Victoria. That piece of legislation went through a lengthy consultation period, and we were able to make sure that the views of our community were properly represented. But most importantly, that we were able to ensure that, you know, consent, I think consent's often thought about in very straight terms, and to make sure that it was thought about in ways that didn't have negative impacts for our community.
So in this context, what does affirmative consent mean?
Yeah, so the law in Victoria changed last year so that when somebody is accused of a sexual offence, whether it's rape or some other lesser sexual offence, anything down to sexual assault, then it will be necessary for the defendant, not in order for them to demonstrate that they had a genuine belief in consent, they will need to have done something or said something to establish that the other person was consenting. So the law doesn't change a lot through this, but it does really send a signal. You can't just assume that someone's consenting in any sexual environment. You need to do something. And you need to be able to explain to the court, if it goes that far, that you took steps to make sure that the other person was consenting.
So it's about being proactive and providing a safe space for others.
That's right. And I think most people would agree these are good changes to the law. There are complexities about the way that they apply to our community. And in particular, there were early drafts of that legislation included a provision that we were really worried about for our communities. And that was a provision that said that any sexual consent obtained by fraud would be null and void. And while that sounds okay, when you get into the details of how that might work for some groups in our community, it's problematic. And that's specifically people with HIV and also transgender diverse people.
You have been very involved in community discussions about police marching at Pride March, having a presence at midsummer events. How has that activism progressed? Where's that at?
Look, I think that's an ongoing debate, not just here in Victoria, not just here in Australia. It's a worldwide issue. We come from a history where we have been criminalised and often physically brutalised by police. The police are, we're told, not like that anymore. The police are still, however, a really problematic institution in our society. There's certainly a lively debate about the participation of police in pride events around the world, including here in Melbourne.
I mean, the police have been visiting venues in a very kind of, you know, friendly, you know, community engagement kind of, you know, campaign, if you like. They've even, I think, going to be doing something at Hare Hole, which is interesting, just before it closes. Is it just PR, or is it achieving meaningful change, do you think?
Look, I do think that you would be wrong to say the police haven't changed in the last 40 or 50 years. That would be a really foolish thing to say. But the police exist really only for one purpose in society, and that is to maintain the social order. And whether you're inside the tent or outside the tent, then the way the police do that is through force and through often oppression of differing points of view. So we see that through the police's push for increased powers in relation to activists and protesters. We've seen that in New South Wales, where a young woman has been imprisoned for blocking traffic on the Sydney Harbour Bridge. It's really problematic, and that stuff is coming often from the police union, and from the police as a political activist group in our society. I think, always have to maintain the perspective that as a historically criminalised community, we need not just to come inside the tent, we need to widen the tent, we need to bring other people into the tent. And that means we need to be sticking up for the rights of Indigenous people, Sudanese people, people of colour, of all types, trans people, homeless people, drug users, etc., who are still the target of a lot of police harassment and discrimination. If we're going to make our achievement of decriminalisation and our achievement of liberation mean something, then the only way to do that, in my opinion, is to make it available to everyone.
Because when it comes to criminalisation, some sections of our community have been left behind, haven't they? Like drug users, you know, sex work was recently decriminalised, so, you know, there's a lot of, you know, overhang and baggage from that still to be resolved with police and with, you know, social acceptance and stigma. There's a long way to go.
Yeah, the repeal of the Sex Work Act in Victoria was an absolute landmark for our community and for sex workers of all communities. Also really important for people with HIV, because people with HIV previously were not allowed to practice as sex workers, and that is now a law that is in the bin where it always belonged.
So people living with HIV can now be sex workers in Victoria. That's an area, that's a reform that hasn't got really much media coverage at all.
No, well, I mean, you might initially think, oh, I'm not sure if I feel great about people with HIV working as sex workers. The simple truth is that people with HIV, no matter whether they're sex workers or not, when they have sex, they have an obligation to take steps to make sure that there's a minimal risk of HIV transmission. That we've always said that those laws should apply equally to sex workers in the same way they apply to everyone else. And that's the law now today.
And of course, you know, you've got to take into account U equals U, you know, undetectable equals untransmissible. And that, of course, applies with sex work as well. If someone's on antiretrovirals, they've probably got no detectable viral load.
Yeah, and someone with no detectable viral load is incapable of transmitting HIV. That is one of the great scientific success stories of our time.
So what other activism do you think needs to be happening in Victoria in terms of other areas of law reform? Where are the gaps that come up for you?
Look, there's always going to be issues around sexual offences. As I said before, we were able to get that broad fraud provision removed from the draft legislation, but we're still waiting to see how these new consent laws operate in practice. There's a lot of questions about how they work, for example, for people in beats or people in sex on premises venues, or how protective they might be for people who have been the target of sexual abuse of different kinds, particularly in our venues. So a bit of a watching brief on that, I think, is really important. You mentioned drug use, and of course our community, like all communities, sometimes celebrate our events by using drugs. That's something that is an ongoing issue in Victoria. I do hope we will see reform, at least in relation to cannabis, in the next period of government. There's the numbers in the Senate that have been taken by the Legalised Cannabis Party would seem to encourage that we might finally see some movement on that. Supporting people of colour, supporting activists, supporting protesters, that's really important work and that we need to continue, and we need to push back against the incredibly politically powerful forces that are pushing for those kinds of laws.
Yeah, it's interesting with the drug law reform, especially marijuana reform. I mean, those two legalised cannabis MPs in the upper house, support for it seems to be, you know, existent in the Labor Party, but Dan Andrews seems to be dragging his feet on that. That's a bit disappointing. Hopefully he'll have a change of heart.
Well, hopefully he'll be pushed into having a change of heart, because I don't know if it's going to happen by itself. Fiona Patten, in the last term of Parliament, chaired a committee that produced an extensive report recommending a liberalisation of the law in relation to cannabis. It's happening around the world, and, you know, Victoria, our Labor, the Andrews government, likes to hold itself up as an incredibly progressive and modern government, but this is one area where they're really regressive. In my own work, I do see people being criminalised for drug possession. A lot of the time, it is you know, not an appropriate way of managing the issue of drugs in our community. You know, and there are issues that arise out of drugs, but certainly the number of times I've appeared in court for somebody who's been in possession of some methamphetamine or some cannabis or whatever, and you don't see that process doing anything positive apart from really ruining someone's life because of their decision to use drugs.
And of course, more rehab, you know, facilities need to be made available instead of building more prisons.
Yeah, for sure. We've got a one of the largest prison populations in the world on a per capita basis.
Really?
Here in Victoria.
I didn't know that.
We certainly have the largest prison population in Australia. We put more people in prison, and we have more people, really disturbingly, on remand in Victoria, in percentage terms, than other states. The number of people on remand in Victoria is a disgrace. There are many, many thousands of people, often really vulnerable people who can't get bail and who are locked up while they have to await their legal matters to be dealt with. There has been a magnificent coroner's report, very, very sad reading, about Veronica Nelson, an Indigenous woman who died in custody. That report makes recommendations for bail reform that the Andrews government have said that they will act on, and that will reduce prison numbers if they do so, but we have to see the detail of that.
Paul Kidd, it's been an absolute joy to speak with you in the marquee here at the Victoria Pride Street Party, the 3CR broadcaster. Thank you so much for sharing your insights, and great to see you.
Thank you so much, and happy Pride to everyone this year.
You are in your face on 3CR, and here's Simo Sue.
Tomorrow is-
Susie and the Banshees there with Passenger. We are broadcasting from the Victoria Pride Street Party. You are listening to 3CR. Up next is PX Farno, but taking us there are the Style Council with Shout to the Top.
Shout to the top, shout. Ooh, I wanna shout to the top, shout. jump.